There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
On January 13, 1998, a man working on the cleaning crew at a large hospital outside Washington, D.C., was going through his normal routine, emptying trash cans and sweeping floors, when he unlocked a door. A door that led to a suite of offices and examination rooms inside the Family Health Center on the fourth floor of the hospital's main building. An office that functioned as a primary care facility where patients not admitted to the hospital could come for regular appointments. It was just after 9 p.m., a time of night the offices would normally be empty. As Fred Reynolds walked into the hallway, he looked to his right and saw the body of a woman on the floor. Sherry Crandall was inside her office, unconscious. Her neck was bloody, she was half naked, and her hands were tied behind her back. The office was ransacked. Reynolds, who was training for a job on the crew, told his co-worker to call for help over the two-way radio they shared. He then immediately began CPR. Four floors below, in the Prince George's Hospital Center's emergency room, doctors and nurses were told what was happening, and several rushed upstairs to help. They immediately took over for Reynolds, cleared Sherry's airway, checked for a pulse, and continued CPR, but Sherry was still unresponsive. Acting quickly, the first responders knew they had to get Sherry down to the emergency room where advanced life support was waiting. She was loaded onto a gurney and rushed to a bank of elevators across the hall. Inside a curtained-off room on the ground floor of the hospital's emergency room, doctors frantically tried to save Sherry's life. But 30 minutes after being found inside her office, Sherry Crandall was dead. The 50-year-old nurse and administrator had been viciously attacked, stabbed, raped, and strangled. It's now just before 10 at night at the sprawling 40-acre campus, and the normally busy hospital is humming with activity. It's windy and about 45 degrees as detectives begin to arrive. With no one in custody and so many people to question, officials with the Prince George's County Police quickly realize they need more help. Nearly every detective working in the county that night is told to drop what they're doing and head to the hospital, located in Cheverly, Maryland, about 5 minutes outside the District of Columbia. They were also told the hospital would not be closed. Patients needed to be cared for, which meant police had their work cut out for them. Meanwhile, Sherry's boss, Dr. Clark Holmes, after learning what happened, rushed from his nearby home back to the hospital. He headed right for the emergency room, where he saw the aftermath of the frantic effort to save her life. He knew Sherry well. He knew her three children, and he knew she was going through a divorce. He also knew word of what happened would spread fast, and he had to get in touch with her family. Reporters were already starting to arrive, parking their news vans outside the emergency room. It was just a matter of time before news of the murder would be all over local radio and TV. Dr. Holmes called Sherry's estranged husband John and her son Darren and told them to get to the hospital. Inside Sherry's office, investigators were getting a first look at what happened. Crime scene photos show evidence of a struggle. Items were scattered all over the floor. A phone without a cord, a single shoe, one of Sherry's, a slip-on, is on the floor, next to a wristband with a whistle attached. Desk drawers are pulled out and left open. The office suite where Sherry worked was now the center of attention. Investigators began asking lots of questions. Where was Sherry last seen alive? Did anyone hear anything? Cries for help? Was there anything suspicious anyone had noticed in or around the Family Health Center? Sherry's secretary, Shirley Montague, told police she last saw her boss walking back from the cafeteria with a can of soda. That would have been at the end of the workday, sometime between 5:30 and 6. Sherry often worked late, and it wouldn't have been unusual for her to be the last of the 32 doctors, nurses, and staff members who worked in the Family Health Center to leave for the day. The hospital's administrator, Alan Atzrut, later told reporters Sherry was probably there late, sending a ton of email messages. Investigators would later find out the last one she sent was at 6:34 p.m. The housekeeper who found her body later told police he and the woman training him saw Sherry working alone in her office between 7:15 and 7:30, a little over 2 hours before her body was found, putting time of death sometime between 7:30 and 9:15 p.m. But who would have killed Sherry Crandall? Why did they do it? And how did they get away without a hospital full of people hearing or seeing anything? I'm Paul Wagner, and this is Murder in a Safe Place. Until recently, I was a reporter at WTTG-TV, Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., where I covered crime in and around our nation's capital. Sherry's murder caught my attention in 2003 when, after 5 years, no one had been charged with the crime. The police wanted help, and so I profiled the case in a 5-minute story that aired in the 10 o'clock news. That's when I first met Sherry's daughter, Tiffany, and Detective Bernie Nelson, the lead investigator in the case, and still the lead investigator 23 years later. The hope was the story would generate new leads, but no one called Crime Solvers that night, and the $26,000 reward remained on the table. In 2014, I featured the story again, but like before, no one picked up the phone. Then, in January of 2020, I approached Tiffany about producing a podcast series on her mother's murder. She spoke with her two brothers, one a police officer, and they all agreed it was worth a shot. Tell an in-depth story about a crime that shocked this region. Maybe this time it would make a difference and bring closure to the family, Sherry's friends, and co-workers. But I also needed help from the police. I had known Detective Nelson for 17 years by then, but I needed the department's full cooperation. They agreed, after listening to what I wanted to accomplish, to get as many people as possible to listen to the details of a deeply troubling unsolved cold case. With the incredibly wide reach of podcasts, maybe that one elusive tip would finally come in. When I started working on this podcast a year ago, I thought I already knew everything there was to know about this case. I thought, for the most part, I would be retelling the story to an audience that had never heard it, in the hope that someone might have answers. I couldn't have been more wrong. What I've learned over the past year as I've investigated this case has genuinely shocked me. But it's also given me extreme hope, because after 23 years with virtually zero leads or answers, suddenly, in the past 8 months, as I've been producing this podcast, police have uncovered new information, bringing them closer than ever to solving this case. As you come along on this journey with me, I'm going to tell you everything I've learned and am still learning. By the end, justice for Sherry might not seem so far out of reach.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The night Sherry was killed, her 16-year-old son Luke was waiting for her at home. He and I had never met, and when we sat down in a Kensington, Maryland park, I found him instantly likable. He has an easygoing way about him and was willing to share what the murder of his mother had done to his life. Luke is 39 now. He's tall, wears his hair short or shaved, and has the build of a man who works hard. He's a blue-collar guy, a proud member of Operating Engineers Local 99. He's also a proud dad. He's married and the father of four. When we met for the interview, the pandemic had just arrived, and so we talked outside at a picnic table while children played nearby. I asked Luke to take me back to January 13, 1998, and tell me everything he remembered about that night.
Yeah, the night that we got the phone call, my brother and I were at home. I had spoken to my mom that morning, and the last thing that we talked about was a stereo that her and I had gotten for Christmas. I was having issues with the CD player, and she said, "You know, don't worry. You know, when I get off work, we'll go to Best Buy and we'll take it and have them look at it." You know, that's typical her after a long day's work, you know, having to come home and deal with something like having to go to Best Buy and deal with an issue with a stereo, you know. So she said, you know, I get off work and we'll take care of it. And I said, okay. And then I was at home and my brother, he got the phone call and he said, something happened to mom. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, and I could tell something was going on because of the way that he was acting. You know, it's not like she twisted her ankle. You know, it wasn't like she came up with the flu or, you know, she, I knew something was going on. He said, I have to go. Dad's on his way to pick you up. And I was kind of wondering, you know, why can't I just go with you? You know, but I never asked him. And he said, just stay here and wait for Dad. So I'm pacing the house, you know, walking around in circles, looking out the front window, kind of wondering where is he? You know, why is he not here? What's going on? And my dad got there, and I came out, got in the car, and he began to drive away, and then he stopped, and he put it in park, and I knew something right then, something was going on. And he was like, did your brother tell you what happened? And I said, no, he didn't tell me what happened. What happened? And he said, your mother was, she was killed tonight. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, she, you know, somebody hurt your mother and she's dead. And I was destroyed. I didn't really believe him at first. So I told him, I said, I don't know what you're saying. Just go there. Whatever. And so we got on Route 50, and I've never seen my dad drive that fast before.
Route 50 is a major six-lane highway connecting Washington, D.C. with the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. The town of Bowie, where the Crandall kids live with their mom, is about midway between Annapolis and Washington, D.C. The trip to the hospital that night, with the heaviest traffic going the other way, would have taken no more than 25 minutes. At the time his mother was killed, Darren Crandall, the middle child, was 20 years old and finishing up his education at the University of Maryland. He and I had never met. He's dark-haired, tall, and has the build of someone who works out. Now in his early 40s, Darren is a sergeant with a major metropolitan police force. He asked us not to disclose which one. I discovered he's a soft-spoken guy. He's married and the father of two. Just like Luke, Darren and I also met up in a park to discuss what he remembered about that night. He says after he got the call from Dr. Holmes, he left his brother behind, hopped in his Jeep, and was first in the family to arrive at the hospital. Darren says he parked in a fire lane outside the emergency room, where he noticed a TV reporter live on the air.
There were police everywhere when I got there, police outside, police cars everywhere. So I knew something was pretty, more than you normally see at a hospital. So I went inside the emergency room doors and looked up on a television. And I remember seeing a news broadcaster, reporter outside, doing a news broadcast. And it was a female, I don't remember what station, but I remember walking into the emergency room and looking up at a television there. And again, another one of these, moments there in history you'll remember. It was a box television, old box television, kind of hung up on the wall with a rack, and I remember looking at it, and it was the person I saw outside doing a news broadcast, and they were saying that a hospital employee had been killed at the hospital. And I just remember, just feeling my heart pounding, just not knowing, now that can't be it. So I went in the emergency room, and I walked around, and I saw Dr. Holmes. And I remember because he was wearing business attire like he normally wears. His tie was up, his hair was slicked back like he always looks. But he looked very flustered. He looked like very stressed and flustered. And he was talking to some doctors or nurses by a curtain. There were two police officers in the emergency room standing by that bed that was curtained off. And it was kind of one of these where he was, doing something intently, and then he turned and looked at me, and then...
You knew each other?
We knew each other, yeah. I'd been to the hospital many times.
So he recognizes you're here. He may not know that you don't know at this point.
I think so. I think he intended for my... to tell my dad and then have my dad disseminate that information to us, which would be the right way, but I remember seeing him kind of just stop what he was doing. I just felt like everybody in the emergency room was looking at me when I came in. So it's standing there looking over at, kind of like the music stops and like everyone's looking at the person that just walked in. And I was just standing there looking around the room. I just felt like, what's going on here exactly, So took a couple steps towards him, and he walked towards me pretty quickly. And there was just a small, crack in the curtain. You can kind of see just a little bit into where that room was. And I walked up and I said, where's my mom? He said, I'm sorry, but she's dead. And I said, no, I talked to you on the phone. You said something happened. I'm here because something happened. Where is she? He said, I'm sorry, but she's dead. And I said, I don't understand what you're saying exactly. What do you mean by that? He said, I can't say it another way. She's dead. She was killed. And I said, by who? I don't understand. It's a hospital. Where did this happen? And I said, where is she? And he just kind of put his hands out and he said, there's nothing you can do now. He said, it's what's done is done, and something to that effect. I said, well, I want to see her. Where is she? And I wanted to almost verify for myself that maybe he's wrong. Maybe a mistake has been made. In my own 20-year-old mind, I was just thinking, any victim or any person who sees or hears someone dead, I want to see for myself. And he said, she's over there. He said, but you don't want to see her like this. He said, you don't want to remember your mom the way she looks now. I said, well, how does she look? And he's like, she doesn't look good. And he said, she's gone. He said, why don't we go upstairs and we can talk more about it. So I never got a look, you know, behind there. I could just see enough in there where I could see her legs, like the side of her leg in there, and I could see what appeared to be something like wrapped around her legs. I'm not sure exactly what it was, if it was like a, in retrospect, it might have been like a piece of clothing or something that's wrapped on one of her legs, but it didn't look normal, whatever it was. And I could see just enough in there to see that there was a person in there, but I couldn't see her face. So I remember thinking to myself, like, should I go in and ask to see her and say I want to see her, or should I just go with his advice and just, you know, be done with it? Not be done with it, but just go with his advice and not submit myself to that. And I've kind of always wondered about that. Did I make the right decision by not going in there and seeing, or was it better for me not to see ultimately? Like, as visions go through my mind now, that vision would be there now. Mm. And do I want to see it again, or did I really need to see it, or did I just want to see it? Or I wrestle with that all the time.
While Dr. Holmes led Darren into a separate room, his father John and brother Luke were arriving at the hospital. But there was still another member of the Crandall family that was in the dark. Tiffany, the oldest of the three siblings, was at Penn State University, 3.5 hours away and hard to reach. Cell phones weren't as prevalent back then, and so friends showed up at her door late that night and gave her a number to call. Tiffany is now in her mid-40s and the mother of two boys. She's an athletic blonde who swam for Penn State on a scholarship. For years, she's worked in the fashion industry and is currently a buyer for Rackroom Shoes and Off-Broadway Footwear in Charlotte, North Carolina. The two of us talked in one of Fox 5 studios, just as the coronavirus was beginning to spread throughout the U.S.
I remember opening the door and just being happy to see them and realizing they weren't here for a happy reason. And they had a piece of paper with a phone number on it, and they said, you need to call this number. And I recognized the exchange as the hospital. I just knew from calling my mom that the first three digits were the hospital, and I thought, my brother. Something happened to my little brother. You know, he was very active, he was very busy, he had a lot of friends, and I just thought right away, oh, and I think I even said, like, oh, you know, something happened to my brother Luke. And they didn't really acknowledge yes or no, and I started to get nervous that it wasn't Luke. But I just thought, okay, well, I'm just going to call. So I called, and my father answered the phone. He must have been in a conference room somewhere waiting to hear from me. And I was in a room by myself, and I remember him saying, Tiffany, I'm at the hospital. There's been an accident. And he said, your mother was murdered. And I physically couldn't hold the phone. I remember it falling out of my hands and dropping to the ground, and just, I had no control. I screamed, and I went back and picked up the phone, and I just said, are you sure? Are you sure? Can you check again? Check her again. Just check. It's okay. She's okay, just keep checking her. And I just, my brain was saying, you know, fix it, just make it better. And unfortunately, you know, there was no fixing. So that's how I found out.
I could hear her screaming through the phone. you know, screaming and just being inconsolable, you know, through the phone, just screaming through the phone, you know, what, how could this happen? What happened? I can't believe this. No, you know, just so loud. It was, you know, my dad couldn't even keep the receiver to his ear, which made it louder for me to hear. So my brother was sitting in the same room and he was sitting there, you know, with tears in his eyes, not really knowing what to say or what to do, same as me.
My dad called my mother's parents and I could hear them crying on the phone, you know, through his phone that he was speaking on. It was, he had made some phone calls and I just, after a while, I just didn't want to be there anymore. It just seemed surreal. I just wanted it to end. I just wanted to go home and forget about it. And just wake up and pretend that it never happened. It was the worst night of my life.
I was 4 hours away. It was not going to be safe for us to drive in that condition. And at that time of night, it was probably close to 11 or 12 o'clock by the time, with the internet and my roommates and finding me. So we had to wait until the morning. And I can almost remember it like it was yesterday, looking out the window of that apartment building, just staring. And just staring and just willing the morning to come so we could go.
And then you get home and you pull up to the house in Bowie and it's already a major news story. You're greeted by a reporter.
Yeah, again, you have to remember back in those days, information wasn't as readily available. It wasn't like people were texting me saying, you know, be careful when you drive up or you're going to see this, or you couldn't go on Facebook and look at news. And so we pulled up and I was shocked to see news cameras there, reporters, lots and lots of cars. I couldn't even get into my driveway. And people wanting to know, you know, here comes the daughter and let me talk to her. And so immediately all my brothers and my brother's friends just surrounded me and got me in the house. And that's how I was greeted when I came home.
So you get there and you must have just been filled with a million questions. What happened? What did you know at that point?
I think early on we knew that she had been strangled. And I think that's all we knew at first. Maybe the first day or the first few days. And then we started to find out more of what happened in that room, theories about what possibly could have happened. And then we just started trying to figure out who did this. You know, when my father called me that night, I thought after he told me, after I processed that information, it, almost in my mind, I could see someone, you know, running out the door, just running away. And I just thought, well, it's a hospital. It's a very busy place. There's people everywhere. It wasn't that late at night. Someone just grabbed the guy. They caught him. And he didn't have that information for me. There was no one caught. And I think at that point, I still thought they would find the person, but maybe just not that night. Maybe it would come in the next day or two.
There was someone else the hospital called the night of Sherry's murder. Shirley Montague. She was the co-worker who saw Sherry coming back with a soda from the cafeteria at around 5:30 that night. Most likely one of the last people to see Sherry alive.
That night, round about, I think it was round about, because my husband always watched the news. It was round about 10:30, and the phone rang. So I said, TV was off, and I said, if it's for me, tell whoever it is, I'm sleeping. I lied. And I heard him say, I'm sorry, yeah, she's fine. My wife is fine. She's here. She's fine. and he hung up the phone. So about 10 minutes later, the phone rang again. And he said, yeah, I just told someone that she's okay, she's fine. So I said, Monty, give me the phone. And he passed it over to me. And I said, hello. And the guard was the security guard. Said, surely this is what, I can't think of his name. I'm just checking on you to see if you're okay. I said, why? What's wrong? He said, we found Sherry Crandall in the office dead this evening. She had been murdered.
So when you got up that next morning after learning about what had happened to her, you recall your frame of mind, your demeanor, what it was like?
I was afraid. My husband always left for work at 3:30. When he left that morning, I was so afraid. I didn't know what to do. I just got up and sat in the chair. I was afraid to go back to sleep. So finally, I laid my head on the table and fell off to sleep, and the clock went off around 6:30. And I would wait until daylight.
Shirley Montague is retired from her job at the hospital. She's a widow now and lives in a tidy red brick single-family home on a tree-lined street in central Prince George's County. We met on her back porch where we talked about Sherry and what she remembered about her boss's last hours.
I got ready and I went over to work, and there was a big meeting called of all the employees. And they told everyone what had happened.
What do you recall about that next day? This was a meeting that they held with, what, the Family Health Center?
Yeah, all of us who worked together, who worked with Sherry. The doctors, the nurses, nurses' aides. And I think there were two clerks, me and another. I think it was one over there, two of us. And we just sat around with the police asking questions. In the library, went into the library, and we sat around answering questions.
So the police wanted to ask you questions?
All of us.
What did they want to know?
Who do we think may have done it, and why, and what the last person to see her, and what was she doing? And I said I was the last employee here to see her. Everyone else was gone, I thought.
I was at home on the night of the murder. I knew I was up on call for the next homicide in the county. It was a shock when they told me that they had a homicide inside the hospital. I didn't believe it initially. However, shortly thereafter, I came to realize that it was true. And it was, like I said, a shock. I was surprised. I've been in that hospital hundreds of times. It's the largest and busiest hospital in the county. So I've been in there many times for other reasons, but never to investigate a homicide that actually took place inside its walls.
That's Detective Bernie Nelson, the original lead investigator in the murder of Sherry Crandall and still the lead investigator today. I've known Bernie since 2003 when I first profiled Sherry's murder for Fox 5. He's a middle-aged guy with a stocky build, a full beard, and a shaved head, but he's quick to laugh. He's just an easygoing guy. When we talked in 2020, the investigation was 22 years old. We're talking 22 years later, but do you remember what you were thinking when you were driving over there?
Well, I knew I had a red ball on, on my hands. I knew it was going to be a cluster. So I was already prepared to see everybody who's anybody at the hospital. With that in mind, I went there to just concentrate on what I needed to do. But a lot of stuff was racing through my mind while I was driving to the hospital.
What's a red ball?
A red ball is when you have a case that you know is going to draw a lot of media attention, possibly even political attention. Being the largest hospital in the county, I knew that that was going to happen as well. So I knew it was a big case and that it could make or break you. So you're nervous, but at the same time, you drum up the energy to push forward. And I knew that it was going to be several days before I can get any sleep once I got that phone call about what just took place.
And how long had you been a homicide detective at that point?
Well, that was in 1998, so I was in homicide for 4 years at that time. I came to homicide in 1994.
What's your first recollection of what you saw when you got to the hospital?
Well, it was busy. There were actually too many people on the scene. I know that we had possibly even the entire evidence unit working the scene, collecting evidence. We actually kept the Family Health Center in which this took place. We kept that to ourselves for 3 days so that we can make sure that everything was processed and processed correctly. We had detectives everywhere. The hospital was extremely busy at that time. And I noted when her body was first discovered in her office that there were a lot of people responding from the hospital itself, from the emergency room. So I knew that the scene was going to be trampled over by a number of people. Maybe items of evidence may have been moved from its original location. So we had to keep that in mind as well when we processed the scene. But it was hectic. It was definitely a hectic scene.
And everybody knew her. Everybody in the hospital knew her. And that doesn't mean that she got extra care. I mean, they got called to her office. They almost completely destroyed the interior of her office, trying to resuscitate her there, get her on a stretcher, and get her down to the emergency room.
Mike McQuillan was the commander of homicide at the time of Sherry's death. He has a lanky build, silver hair, and speaks in a manner that tells you he's choosing his words carefully. I've known Mike longer than I've known Bernie. He spent 31 years with the Prince George's County Police and nearly 9 years as head of the squad. The night Sherry Crandall was viciously killed, he was still in his office at police headquarters in Palmer Park, Maryland. He remembers the call coming in at around 9:30 p.m.
There's nothing that surprises me, Paul. Over the years, you get a call and you just go, let's go. All cases are important. But when you get somebody murdered, a nurse murdered in her office, in her workplace, in the county hospital, things that run through your mind just drive into the scene. You got to coordinate it. Really what my job was.
So you're on Barlow Road. Mm-hmm. You get into your cruiser, and you're heading to the hospital.
Straight up 202.
At that time, cell phones were in cars at that time, so you had cell phone service.
I had a cell phone.
Yeah. Were you getting information as you were driving over?
No. What I was really doing was making notifications to the commander of CID, all the way up to the chief of police. I even talked to the chief on the way.
To let him know what you had.
Well, actually, he called me.
Now, were you there all night?
All night and all day and the next day. We didn't release that scene for several days.
As Mike McQuillan was making his notifications, Detective Nelson was getting his first look at the crime scene.
What I recall seeing when I first got to the office were too many people. We had to clear some people out that didn't need to be there so our evidence techs can properly process the scene and we can preserve it as much as possible. But her office itself Now, her body was already down in the emergency room where they worked on her in hopes of saving her life, but they were unsuccessful. So in the office, it looked like it was rummaged through. Papers were all over the floor. Stuff was in disarray. I do recall one of the things that we concentrated on was a fundraiser candy box that she had in her office, which should have had some money inside of it. We did find some medical evidence that they worked on her in the office. We found some medical devices on the floor inside her office. So everything was in disarray, as if it was rummaged through. And it may have been rummaged through prior to her actually being murdered. But it was a hectic and chaotic scene.
How long before you realized what had actually happened to her?
Well, I had already received a brief synopsis when they first gave me the call when I was home, that a cleaning person found her in the office, deceased, that she was finally pronounced in the emergency room, and that they may have a possible witness that we had to deal with. So I already knew basically that someone was seen strangling her when I first got to the scene, so we had to work from there.
A witness? In my 19 years covering this case, I had never been told about any witness to the murder of Sherry Crandall. It has never been in any news report about the case, nor has it come up in any of my discussions with police until now. Detectives kept this detail to themselves for more than two decades. But why? What is its significance, and why wait all these years to tell a reporter? That's coming up in Episode 2 of Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series.
This witness indicated that she didn't know if the male may have been trying to help her or was actually assaulting her.
And as the investigation continues, police uncover something startling, an email from Sherry to hospital administrators expressing her concerns over recent thefts at the hospital and her fear that something worse might happen.
Sherry Crandall actually almost predicted her demise.
Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written and produced by me, Paul Wagner, and CaseJackets.com. For more on the Sherry Crandall case, go to AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to SpotlightDC.org. Have a question you'd like to see answered in a future show? Email me at paul@wtop.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at AM Nightmare Pod and on Facebook at facebook.com/AM Nightmare Pod. If you know anything about the murder of Sherry Crandall, you're asked to call Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-TIPS. This podcast series would not be possible without the help of Sherry's three children, the Prince George's County Police, Shirley Montague, Detective Bernie Nelson, and Mike McQuillan. Editorial assistance from Julia Ziegler and Craig Schwab. Music for this episode is Runway 47 by Immersive Music and Flum Flum by Up North Music. Subscribe to Murder in a Safe Place on Podcast One, Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And thanks for listening.